Welcome again to Talkonomics. I'm Adam Shapiro, and we talk about just about everything here. Your money, your choices, the mistakes we make with all of those things, and some of the things we do correctly. Now, a term that a lot of us have heard for the past couple of years is income inequality. When I lived in Cleveland, Ohio, I didn't know to call it income inequality, but I witnessed it every day because I would drive from Cleveland Heights to my job at WEWS Woos in Cleveland. And I would go through a neighborhood. I would come down Carnegie Boulevard, and I would go through a neighborhood at roughly, it was 113th Street on my way downtown. And I would pass absolutely devastated houses. They were abandoned. The streets were abandoned. There were still people living there. This was an incredibly impoverished neighborhood. But this had once been a thriving middle-class neighborhood. And it used to just tear me apart because I used to think about the incredible waste of that housing stock and the infrastructure. But more important, the people. The incredible waste of people. And I used to cover stories with people in those neighborhoods. I used to volunteer in the Cleveland public school system, helping kids learn how to read. And one of the things that I learned about this term income inequality, which I didn't know then, was I had this young boy. His family had moved here, I assumed from Mexico, but he was a Spanish language first person. And he did not speak English. And he had wound up with me because they said he did not know how to read. He did know how to read. He knew how to read Spanish, you know, children's versions, but he knew how to read. He didn't know how to read English because he didn't speak English. And his family had no one to advocate for him and say to the school, he can read, he just doesn't speak English, he needs to be in an English as a second language program. So those are the kinds of things that I witnessed in Cleveland. And that brings me to today's guest, Robert Putnam. He grew up in Port Clinton, Ohio, which is west of Cleveland, but he has witnessed in his lifetime this issue that we now all call income inequality. And he is currently a professor of public policy at Harvard University, served as dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, is a member of the National Academy of Sciences. In 2006, he received the Skite Prize, the world's highest honor for a political scientist. In 2012, he received the National Humanities Medal, the nation's highest honor for contributions to the humanities. You know him because he's written several books, 14, including the best-selling Bowling Alone, I think it was in 2000, Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of the American Community. In 2015, just last year, his book Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis, hit the New York Times bestseller list and offered all of us a glimpse into the dramatic changes that have taken place over the last 40 years that I guess you could say has helped affluent Americans maintain their affluence and become better off, has also the changes in as they've hit impoverished Americans, they've become worse off. And the middle class has been struggling ever harder to keep up. So the book Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis, is actually being reissued at the end of this month, at the end of April, in paperback. And it couldn't come at a more poignant time as the political debate and the presidential campaign are hitting on these issues of income inequality. So Robert Putnam, welcome to Talkonomics.
Thanks very much, Adam. I'm glad to be with you.
It's good to talk with you. And I'm going to quote you back to yourself. I do this all the time because I read your book and it helped me understand how blessed I was to be born in kind of a golden age. I guess you would describe it as the 40s, 50s, 60s, in which there was more of a level playing field when it comes to opportunity. But at the very beginning in chapter one, The American Dream, you write, in modern America, one barrier would loom larger than it did back then. Their class origins. Usually we talk about things, I guess, in terms of race, but you talk about class and you say that that nationwide increase in class inequality, how the class-based opportunity gap among young people has widened in recent decades, is the subject of this book. Is that income inequality that we're talking about?
Well, it's related to income inequality, but really it isn't exactly the same thing as income inequality. It has to do with the impact of the growing inequality in parents' income on kids. There are three big changes that have happened that we all know about, or at least some of them we know about. This distribution of income among American families has become much less equal over the last 30 or 40 years, and we know about that mainly because it's one of the key subjects in the presidential election campaign this year. And there are big, as we can see, both on the Republican side and on the Democratic side, there are big differences between folks who've done pretty well over the last 30 or 40 years and folks who have not done well at all. And so that's income inequality. what this book looks at is what difference does that make for kids? And what we find is that there's a growing gap, not just in the income of adults, but in the opportunities open to kids. Americans historically have not been as worried as many other peoples have about the distribution of income. We sort of assume if everybody's getting on the ladder at the same point and some people, you know, climb higher, it's because they're better climbers or they work harder at it. We don't begrudge, you know, Bill Gates or Warren Buffett their high incomes on the assumption that we're all getting on the ladder at the same point. But on that score, which is the inequality of opportunity or equality of opportunity, Americans have always cared a lot more than people in other countries. We really want, and it's built into the basic idea of the American dream, that how well you do in life should depend upon you and your hard work and your God-given talents, but shouldn't depend upon what your parents did or didn't do.
So you talk about this opportunity gap, and you tell the stories of upper-income individuals, middle-class and lower-income individuals from Port Clinton to Bend, Oregon, to Philadelphia, I think it is. And you wrote, inequality in the United States increasingly operates through education, a scarce resource that is closely correlated with parental socioeconomic status. So essentially, you know, kids who might be growing up in what is Watts in Los Angeles might be going to a public school that 10 miles away, another public school, the kids at that school might have more advantages simply because they're in a better zip code.
That's exactly right. And it's not only in schools, actually. It also, there's been a big change over the same period in family structure. Most kids of all races growing up in poor homes now in what we used to call the working class are living in a single-parent home, almost always with a single mom. At the same time, more than 90% of kids growing up in upper-middle-class homes are growing up with two parents. So these differences, they certainly show up at school, but they begin much earlier. You can see this, what we call scissors graph, a growing discrepancy between kids coming from upper-middle-class homes who are doing fine and kids coming from working-class homes who are definitely not doing fine. As you said before, this is correlated with race, but it's not just about race. That's the important thing I want to emphasize here. You can see these growing gaps between kids coming from well-off homes and poor homes. Even the growth of that gap is concentrated among white kids.
Well, you talk about the young man in Port Clinton whose father, you know, tried to do the best he could but was in and out of jail. And you talk about the problem with incarceration for impoverished children. Tell me more about that, because that seems to be, you know, if you're born into a single parent situation, it seems as if the deck is stacked against you almost at birth.
Yep. It is, and the cards keep turning up even worse for you. That is, if you're born into a working class home in America, I underline that that's any kind of working class, it's not differentiated so much by race. If you're born into a working class home in America, you start off behind the eight ball because you're very likely only to have one parent. Your parents are much less likely to read to you, and so there's a 30 million word gap between kids growing up in poor homes and affluent homes. By 30 million word gap, I mean by the time these kids get to school, kids coming from the upper middle class have heard 30 million more words, and that is a strong predictor of how well they do in school. You can see it in how much
family dinners. Simple things like family dinners that, you know, that I fortunately grew up with. You know, I had dinner with my parents and with my brothers. They didn't read Goodnight Moon to me, which is a book you talk about.
Right.
But, you know, my parents read to me. But, you know, I was on the swim team, not very good in high school. But the kids in the lower incomes today, they don't have family dinner. They don't participate in sports or extracurricular activities. And you talk about this, the pay to play concept. We, you know, in the United States today, a lot of school systems, even in more affluent neighborhoods, require the participants in school sports to pay for their uniforms or the ability to do that. And you think that that's also holding kids back.
Oh, sure it is. We know now that extracurricular activities, you know, band or chorus or football or French club or whatever, we know from hard evidence that matters for how well kids do. Kids who are taking part in extracurricular activities are learning soft skills. They're learning teamwork. They're learning grit, what my mom used to call stick-to-itiveness. And we know, because we can see from the evidence, that kids who do take part in those activities will earn more in their lifetime because employers are willing to pay for those soft skills. So charging kids for access to an important set of learning experiences and skill-building experiences is evil, honestly. We don't charge people to learn, you know, addition and subtraction, and we shouldn't charge them to have access to those same, the equally important soft skills that we get, well, that is, upper-class kids now get from extracurriculars, and working-class kids increasingly do not.
So you talk about at the end of the book what's to be done. And one of the things you say is we should just eliminate across the board the pay-to-play model and even the vouchers. Because when a kid who can't afford to pay gets a voucher, they're stigmatized by the kids who know that they got a voucher, right?
Yeah, the evidence on that, too, is very clear. And it's not surprising if you're thinking about adolescents. Kids do not want to be known as the kid whose parents are too poor, so they have to have a special, dispensation to be allowed to play football. And the evidence is quite clear. If you start charging kids, as we are on average now across America, it costs roughly $800 to take part in one extracurricular activity for a year. If you've got two kids in high school, that means $1,600 a year. If your annual income is $200,000, well, $1,600 is no big deal. But if your annual income is $16,000, who in their right mind is going to spend 10% of their total annual family income on high school sports? And the answer is fewer and fewer working-class kids are getting those experiences.
But it's not just the experience of the team building and the relationship-building concepts and extracurricular activities. You talked about it was the two sisters, I think, in the Los Angeles neighborhood.
Yeah.
And you talk about the experience they have where one could have, if she had been in the right school, might have been assisted by the infrastructure. I think the term is the wraparound of counselors and teachers who might have gotten her into an AP-style program.
Yeah.
But here's, you wrote early in the book, and this seems to be the problem as Americans we encounter. While large majorities favor pragmatic steps to limit inequality of condition, we are also philosophical conservatives, suspicious of the ability of government to redress inequality and convinced that responsibility for an individual's well-being rests chiefly with him or her. So how do we as a society get past that, and how do we help that young woman I'm talking about who was in Los Angeles in her school system? What do we do?
Well, if we're talking about adults, that is, should we redistribute income from one adult to another adult, Americans are willing to think about helping poor adults who are down on their luck. But to some extent, the American view is, well, you know, it's up to you as an adult, you know, pull up your bootstraps. But for kids, it just doesn't make sense. If we talk about David, the poor kid in Port Clinton who's right, living in a completely dysfunctional family, or if we talk about the two young Latino women in Orange County who you're referring to, it makes no sense at all to say, you know, to a five-year-old kid whose family is in disarray and who's living in a terribly dangerous neighborhood and who's going to a poor school, come on, kid, pull up your boots. It just doesn't make sense. And that's why Americans have always, this has not been a matter of party debate in the past. We've been somewhat more reluctant to redistribute income among adults, but we've been always strongly committed to equality of opportunity for kids, all kids. It ought to depend upon you and not upon your choice of parents. And increasingly, how well you do in life in America depends upon your choice of parents and your choice of, you know, their choice of what zip code to live in, and that's just fundamentally un-American.
From your experience, because you actually met all of these people that you talked to and mentioned in the book, the couple in Port Clinton, for instance, the wealthier couple versus David in Port Clinton, you talk about in the book this concept of there was a time when you were growing up that you could have the affluent family living four houses down from the lower income family in the same
right
neighborhood, but there was this concept that everyone was our kids. Is
right
that gone? Do people not think
yeah,
that way anymore?
I'm afraid it is, and I'm not now just talking about Port Clinton. But if we take Port Clinton, when I was growing up in the 1950s, I don't want to make Port Clinton sound like, you know, heaven on earth in the 1950s. Of course, there were a lot of problems, and there was gender bias and
racial bias. You interview a woman you went to school with who said that it was no picnic growing up there.
Absolutely. But what is the case? And we know now because my class of 1959, we're now old, and we know how well we've done. And kids coming from the wrong side of the tracks in that period have done just about as well as kids coming from the right side of the tracks. And moreover, as you say, we all lived together. And when my parents used the expression, our kids, as in, you know, our kids need a swimming pool, we got to build a swimming pool, they were not talking about my sister and me. They meant all the kids at Port Clinton needed a swimming pool, and all the parents ought to pay a little bit more in millage to afford a new swimming pool at the high school. But in Port Clinton and across the country over the last 30 years, the meaning of the term our kids has shriveled. So now if you listen carefully when people talk about our kids, they mean their own biological kids. They don't mean other kids in town. And they say about, you know, affluent people, as indeed one of the people that you just referred to, the, one of the affluent persons at Park Clinton, they think, well, you know, too bad for those poor kids. It's not my kids. It's somebody else's kids. Let them worry about them. And that sense of a shriveling of our sense of obligation to other people's kids is, I think, at the core of this. It's not just a moral problem. I want to emphasize that, Adam. Mm-hmm. It's also an economic problem because what the book shows is it's extremely costly to the whole society if we're throwing away the talents that these
kids
poor
have.
Kids have.
I think you actually use I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but it's something like it costs us $1 trillion if we are to wrap around and provide the services that these kids need very early in life. We're talking pre-K.
Yeah.
But it costs us $4 trillion or more, I think it was, in the lost productivity and then incarcerating or dealing with these kids with dysfunctional problems and their then kids as we go forward.
Absolutely right. It's not as if. I mean, my grandchildren are going to do fine. They, you know, my wife and I are well educated. Our children are well educated, and our grandchildren are going to do just fine. But it's not as if we have to choose between helping my grandchildren or helping, you know, these poor kids. My grandchildren are going to live in a poorer America. I mean, financially as well as morally poorer America, if we don't help the poor kids, because there's a ton of really smart, demonstrably talented poor kids who are not going to get a college degree and not going to be able to contribute to the economy, not because of their own skills or even their own hard work, but because they made a bad choice in parents, and their parents aren't able to afford not just the college tuition, this goes much deeper than that, but have not been able to give them the kind of takeoff speed that my kids or my grandchildren are going to get just because they're my grandchildren.
Well, you know, let's talk about this, because in the conclusion you say the backdrop to the problems facing poor families, poor schools, and poor communities is the stagnant economy that has been virtually no real growth in decades for the less educated part of our population. And you talk about in the book that there's about a 40-year lag time, that when you talk about more income inequality coming and more inequality of opportunity coming, now is when the seeds that were planted 40 years ago are bearing fruit, and it's only going to get worse, right?
That's exactly right. And so we do have to end the wage stagnation.
How?
And, you know, I think that level of this growing level of alienation among people from the working class is actually showing up very vividly in our national politics this year. I know this is an economics program, not a politics program, but I think anybody who's paying attention to this year's politics understands there's an awful lot of anger being expressed, especially by the working class, especially by the white working class, actually. And I'm not so much defending the kinds of political choices that they are making, but it's unmistakable that there is an awful lot of anger out there. So the first thing we need to do is to try to end this wage stagnation. But there are many other things we can do. I won't go through all of them, but the things that are talked about in the book include investing in early childhood development, investing in low-income schools, providing better on-ramps, that is, ways for kids who've gotten off the mainstream to get back on, like community colleges or voc-tech education. But there are also smaller things that each of us individually can do.
Like what?
Like mentoring poor kids. The most important generalization you can make about these poor kids is that they are alone. They're isolated. They can't trust their parents because they live in fragile families. They can't trust their neighborhoods because they're concentrated increasingly in dangerous neighborhoods. They can't trust their schools because they're concentrated increasingly in low-income schools. They can't trust their churches because they're increasingly not at church. They are alone. And that is something we could do things about. These kids lack, among other things, stable, trusting, trustworthy loving adults in their lives. And, of course, we can't replace their own parents, but lots of us could do more in our own communities to provide stable support for these kids.
Well, because, you know, here in New York City, there's been the push for a pre-K for all, providing pre-K. But it's more than just that, because you talk about in the book, you use the example of how as Americans, we go less to our religious organizations. And those religious organizations have actually shown positive intervention for families that are in poverty or falling into these traps that keep them in poverty.
That's right. Yeah, but I mean, as you say, increasingly, working class Americans are less likely to be in church, and therefore their kids are less likely to be exposed to, you know, adults outside the immediate family, like, you know, Sunday school teachers or you know, other people in the congregation who would look out for them.
What about incarceration? Because this is a big issue. I mean, it 20 years ago, there was the big push from people of all races to increase, you know, jail sentences because of what was perceived as the crime problem.
Sure.
But now we've seen that there's a negative consequence to that, as we have kids growing up without a male figurehead at home.
That's an important part of the problem. That part of the problem is concentrated especially among African-American families, because there's this, you know, huge absence of fathers in many African American communities, because they're in prison, and I'm not talking about people in prison for violent crimes. I'm talking about
marijuana
pretty simple
small things,
drug violations. And you know, on this score, this issue of trying to reduce this crazy level of incarceration for nonviolent crimes, there's an emerging consensus across party lines in Washington and in state capitals around the country. So I think over the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to see some significant progress made on that part of the problem. I wanted to go back just for a second, if I could, Adam, to the point about these kids being isolated and the need, therefore, to have mentors in their lives. One way to think about it is all kids do dumb things. That is, your kids, my kids, white kids, brown kids, black kids, rich kids, poor kids, all do dumb things. They get involved with, you know, they drink too much, or they get in a fight with a teacher, or they back the car into the next-door neighbor's garage or whatever. When that happens to a kid coming from an affluent, educated home, instantly airbags inflate to protect the kid from the worst consequences.
You have the story of the mother who, when she finds out her daughter had been smoking drugs, I think it was she calls the parent of the other kid. I think she's off to boarding school at that point.
Right. But if a poor kid, and, you know, if one of my grandchildren I discovered was involved with drugs, the first thing I'd do is, you know, call the best lawyer in town and then the best rehab facility in town. And I don't apologize for that. That's what parents and grandparents do. They try to provide some airbag to keep the kid from their life being destroyed by one dumb decision, and to enable it to be a learning experience. But if a poor kid does exactly the same thing, no airbag. It just is a life-altering and experience, and that's why I say we need a lot of things. We need you know, more less wage stagnation for the lower class, but we also need more care and attention to the other kids in town. We should all think of ourselves as, to some extent, having a responsibility to other people's kids, not just our own biological kids.
But let me – you bring up – and this is the nature of, if you're one of those people who lives in a neighborhood and says, well, those kids over there are not my kids. You talk about the 1930s and the dangers to our republic and to our democracy if we ignore people. And is that somewhat what we're witnessing, do you think? There's a protest today, right now, outside the CEO of Nabisco's house, because she's sending 600 jobs to Mexico.
Right.
You know, that's 600 people, but we saw what happened at Carrier in Indianapolis.
Sure.
You know, eventually people who don't think they have a future get very angry.
It's a combination of two things. I talk about this in the book, even though the book was written, you know, more than a year before this election. What I said was the combination of two things: great economic dislocation and great social isolation. And that's what's true of these kids. Had a high potential for leading these kids, and as they grow up, you know, they become older, they're a potential support for ideologically extremist demagogues. That's the term I used. And without commenting on particular candidates in this election, I do think that all of those, the long 30 years of economic disaster that's hit the working class in America, is now those chickens are coming home to roost. And it's not like I think that the choice of these particular candidates that are appealing to that group is the, you know, I don't think they have necessarily the right solutions, but and sometimes the candidates are saying some pretty astonishing and distressing things, but we ought to understand that the underlying cause of that has been this long neglect by us of other people's kids.
I want to start wrapping up with you. You mentioned, because it gets very depressing, no offense, when you start thinking about those kinds of things. But you also talk about programs that do work. You yep. mentioned, I think it's Jeffrey Canada, who's he's still involved up in Harlem with the program he started there. But
sure.
this concept of wraparound, that you can't just put money into a school, that you've got to actually put money into the services that help the single mother or the single father and that child. You cited the earned income tax credit. You know, Milton Friedman was the one who said this will help the working poor, but it only helps the working poor. But those are the steps we should be taking, right?
Absolutely. Look, the story I tell in this book, Our Kids, is a kind of depressing story. But just in the last minute or two, I want to say, actually, I'm pretty optimistic we could fix this problem. And the reason is America has been here before. There have been previous times in our own history when we've had a great gap between rich and poor. I'm thinking about the Gilded Age at the end of the 19th century, in which there was great social turmoil and ethnic tensions and political shenanigans and a widespread sense in the country that our parties were not helping us solve problems.
And we got the high school movement out of that.
And then Americans invented the high school. Exactly right. Invented the high school, the first time in world history that communities would say to kids, any kid in town, just because you're a kid in this town, you get 4 free years of secondary education. And it began in small towns in the Midwest. It did not begin in, you know, Harvard or Washington, D.C. or New York even. It was ordinary folks in those small towns saying, you know, it's going to be expensive, but let's give everybody's kid in town this free 4-year education. The kids from rich families in town were already getting it because their parents were paying for it, but now the argument was those same affluent adults should pay for other people's kids to get a secondary education. It was the best decision America has ever made, because that one decision, giving free high school education to all kids in town, including other people's kids, that raised the overall growth rate of America so much that it alone accounts for almost all of our economic growth throughout the 20th century, and at the same time it leveled the playing field. What lesson do I draw from that? We're in a pickle now in America, but this is not something that America is unable to solve. I'm not saying we should become like Sweden or something. I'm just saying we have to do what Americans have previously done.
So let me. This is just a thought. This is not from your book, but you know, I go back to my experience in Northeast Ohio. But I've witnessed poverty in Portland, Maine, and in Indianapolis, Indiana. Is anyone doing this kind of program? You talk about the need to assist and wrap around. You know, kind of a situation where you would have not a foster home, but an academy. You could call it, the weekday academy, where a child from one of these families that needs this kind of intervention, Monday through Thursday, goes and lives in a stable environment with 10 other kids and adults who understand what needs to be done for these kids. They go to school, and then on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, they go home so that they can be with their birth family or their single mom or dad. I think the Israelis actually do this, but wouldn't that be one solution to this?
Well, you know, Adam, the reason that I'm a little uneasy about that is that in general, what the evidence says is that if you're a kid, you're better off living with your own family.
Okay.
And therefore, my first priority would not be to say, well, let's give up on these families. It's to say, what can we do to help the what you call birth families of these kids? What can we do to help them be the kind of better parents that they want to be?
They want to be, you point out in the book that they don't possess the skills because they've grown up in the cycle of poverty without the skills to begin with. And they suffer from depression or alcoholism or drug abuse.
Absolutely. All those things are true. And in extreme cases, something like, enabling kids to get out of that environment is a good idea. But we know from the foster care problems around the country that moving a kid out of a really bad home into some other setting is not always a magic, I don't want to say bullet, but a magic wand that's going to change the kids' lives. That's why I do think we need, we know this is a problem that requires a multiple approach. We should think about things that will help the families themselves be more stable economically. That's part of the problem, the making sure that there's better jobs with living wages for the parents. Partly we need to help coach the parents, because many of these parents have themselves never experienced family stability and good parenting. We need to do things in schools, providing much more wraparound support. We need to do things with mentoring. I completely agree with the wraparound idea. I would say myself, though, that taking kids actually out of their natural families and putting them in some other institution would be not my first.
But if you were to offer those parents, it's kind of like boarding school. I used foster care because that was what came to my head. But like a boarding school, where a mother who might realize she can't provide this to her child is saying, okay. And I'm talking about these academies perhaps being in the same neighborhood, but you have a stable 3 meals a day, appropriate adult supervision. But where the child doesn't have to worry about, am I going to eat today? And where the child is surrounded by the peers who don't change, and then goes home on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I mean,
it would be worth exploring, Adam. My own guess is that to take it a scale, would become somewhat more bureaucratic.
But, the last thing we want. You know,
maybe I'm wrong about that. And look, the way I go back to the larger point I made. The way we've solved problems like this in the past is to try a lot of different things in different communities around America. And there are actually now, as I travel around the country a lot, I've been in 130 different community meetings across America over the last year, talking, and you know, from Southern California to Northern New England, and from Seattle to Atlanta, and lots of places in between. What I think we need now going forward is bipartisan, multisectoral groups. By that I mean business groups and nonprofits and school people and so on in local communities. In Decatur, I was just in Decatur a couple of weeks ago, and have them try different things. And you know, they may need outside.
Yeah, it can't come from it can't come from the federal government. It has to be in the, because each state, each community has different needs and desires.
And the last thing you need to do is do serious evidence gathering, so you see what works and actually what sounds good but doesn't work. That's how that same process is how we dealt with the problem of inequality of opportunity 100 years ago. That's how we got the high school. That was one of the local experiments that turned out to be dynamite. Really good. Good. And there were other experiments that turned out not to work. Well, they didn't survive. I think we could do this, but it requires, in fact, I'm sure we could do it, but it requires committed involvement by local people across party lines to figure out how can we solve this opportunity gap, you know, here in Seattle or here in Decatur or here in Port Clinton, my own hometown.
So,
and we can do it, but we just have to raise it to the proper level of priority for us.
And finally, you know, our kids, The American Dream in Crisis, is being reissued at the end of this month in paperback. Last question to you. Why should people read this book now and not wait?
Well, because I think the most important domestic challenge facing our country, if we can't solve this, if we move into a completely two-tiered society with, you know, caste, basically, in which kids coming from upper-class homes do well and kids coming from poor homes do poorly and their kids do poorly, that's going to lead us in a very costly direction as a country, costly economically, costly morally, costly politically. And we can fix this. This is not so, and this is an issue that's being actually discussed in this current presidential campaign. And I think this is no time like the present to get started on this problem.
Robert Putnam, thank you very much for joining us on Talkonomics.
Thanks very much, Adam.
Let me know what you think of Mr. Putnam, and if you've read his book, you know, what you think of the book, Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. You can always reach me on Twitter. My handle, is that what they call it? I guess, yeah, the handle is at AJ Shaps, S-H-A-P-S, at AJ Shaps. And let me know potential guests that you would like to hear on Talkonomics. Just to give you a little hint, we've been talking, you know, today about income inequality and inequality of opportunity. Coming up, I've got the expert in the United States on the millennial generation, the Generation Me author. And I just got to tell you, I work with a lot of 20-year-olds, and I think they get a bum rap. These are hardworking people, and they are underpaid. On the other hand, when you're in your 20s, you're supposed to be underpaid. We've all been there. But we're going to be talking about the millennials and the myths, but also the realities of a generation that does have different values in some respects, especially when it comes to work, than those of us who might be in our 40s or 50s. So, again, thank you for listening. And any questions you have or suggestions you have, send them to me at AJ Shaps at Twitter. All the best to you.